The first question I would like to ask, and that is, David Durr, can you just defend Switzerland against the attacks from Doug Casey against Europe as a whole?
Yes, I just asked him whether he would not reconsider this and nevertheless come to Switzerland. He then told me that he likes Switzerland. And
it's the healthiest horse going to the glue factory.
And then he said it's really also, unfortunately, going downhill. So maybe you could say you need selling propositions they had, you know, with banking services, and so that they lost it in a way. They obeyed to foreign dictates in a way that, which was not even expected by those dictating other countries, really, in a way which is crazy. Nevertheless, I would say Switzerland, but this is daydreaming, you know, but nevertheless, if this project I presented, or maybe other causes, will have the effect that the central state in Switzerland will be dissolved in a way that we will have these 26 part states, but will then be forced or somehow in a way to compete with each other, so that ultimately there will be organizations, there will be gangs, there will be enterprises, there will be a lot of people, but none of them will have a monopoly, this first competence. In such a way, I thought already if one would succeed with that, that could be a sort of a first paradigm, a change of paradigm in a way that there is a small place, something like a Zona Franca, not in the dusty, warm place of Singapore, but a bit in that way, in the, you know, a bit cooler region of the Alps, that small place there between these bigger parts of Germany, of France, and so on. But this was that place lost in a way between these big countries where no central government is there, and people will look at it and say, oh, it's wonderful that it functions, and they have order, they have police services, private of course, they have construction order and everything, but without a monopolist regulating it. There will be order, but not a centralized order, things like that. They don't have taxes. Of course, they have to pay what they use for. They have to pay in a way for infrastructure, things like that. They have a judicial system if they have conflicts. All this they have, but in a non-monopolistic way. And why not to start somewhere with this in Switzerland? Maybe it's after the time you would then move to Switzerland. Maybe it's after the time I will live in Switzerland. But nevertheless, why not to think about
it? Well, just another question Doug Casey, he mentioned Africa. I was surprised about that. I can understand as a speculator, somebody who wants to make money there, that might be a good place. But as somebody going there and wanting to live a safe life, would that be a place that could be recommended, given that we have the experience, for instance, in South Africa, where the property rights of white people have become increasingly endangered. So what is your view on Africa?
Well, as you know, there's not a single country in Africa that should be an actual country, because the Europeans divided it up arbitrarily across tribal and ethnic and linguistic and religious lines. So all of those countries in Africa are going to disappear in the future and become new entities. So that's cause for optimism. the fact that these nation states, which are artificial, are going to all be destroyed. And in that chaos, there's going to be real opportunity if you go there and get connected with the right people. But as a place to live, there's some nice places in Africa, believe it or not. Like my number one choices, I'd go to Namibia, which is a gigantic country. I mean, it must be half the size of Western Europe, and it's full of Germans because it was a German colony. I mean, only 2 million people in this gigantic country. Look at that. Nobody goes there. And I would also go to Mozambique. Now, that's the size of California, but it only has about 13 million people. True, there's another civil war starting, but, you know, I'm just, you know, fortunately, you've got about 45 countries south of the Sahara in Africa, so you've got a wide range of choices. And they're not all bad. Listen, I was in the Congo for a couple weeks between the wars, and I said to myself, you know what, I could live here. Because I stayed for a few days in Goma, which is right on the Rwanda border, and I was staying at a friend's house, and we'd go swimming in Lake Kivu every morning, and Rwanda's right there, like, you know, 300 yards. And I said, what did you do when the war was going on and they were killing 500,000 people with machetes? He said, well, I couldn't go swimming because there were bodies floating everywhere where we're swimming right now. But, you know, while I was there, it was wonderful, high standard of living, pleasant. Everything changes.
There's a very famous statement by Ludwig von Mises. By the way, I'm the only one in the room, I think, who ever shook the hand of Ludwig von Mises, and I never washed my hand since. It's a little dirty, but if you shake my hand, you channel Mises. In any case, there's this very famous statement by Mises that could be used to criticize Doug and all other preppers or people who want to hive off into the wilderness and save themselves. I wish David Gordon were here. He could do it verbatim. I'll do just the gist of it. And what Mises said is, in my words, it's silly to try to save yourself. Nobody can save themselves because if things hit the fan, we'll all be undermined by it. And the only thing we can do is try to promote liberty. Now, this doesn't apply to Doug because he's created more liberty than the next, I don't know, 100 libertarians or the next 1,000 libertarians. So it doesn't apply to him. But it's sort of a different view about trying to go off to some country as opposed to promoting liberty, whereas Doug goes off to other countries and promotes liberty. But I think Mises' point is very well taken, that if things fall apart, there's no saving yourself, and therefore, or there's very little chance of saving yourself, and your life will be nasty, brutish, and short anyway, and therefore you might as well promote liberty. So again, it doesn't apply to Doug, because he does promote liberty par excellence, but I think it's a point that if you have a choice between trying to save yourself and promoting liberty, promote liberty.
I'd like to ask a question of David Durer. My impression of Switzerland is that you've already abolished, in many respects, the nation state, in that the local government in Switzerland is stronger than any other country in the world. The 26 cantons take roughly 70% of all the taxes and most of the social functions are at the cantonal level. So you've already, in Switzerland, achieved a big part of your goal. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, on this, the position of these local state, so to speak, the cantons. Yes, that is. They are quite strong. I would say generally there is a strong tendency, of course, toward the centralization. They used to be the basis originally of Switzerland. By the way, I will come to the fact that my son is member of a government of one of these cantons. It's an interesting story, by the way, that when Swiss as a federation was founded in 1848, that was the change from a federation of states to a federal state. There were at that time, I think, 17 cantons that were in principle independent small states with some treaty binding them together. And some, in principle, they had the right to succeed and things like that. And in any event, because of, you know, a war they had internally between a sub-federation and the whole federation, then they changed to this federal state. And from an international law point of view, that was illegal, because according to the law, to the international law, which was not a codified law but an accepted law, that was only possible with unanimity, with the consent of all 17 cantons. It's really the contrat social, which must be first, in the very first instance, be signed by all members. Of course, then they can agree on majority principles, but not for the beginning. At the very first, all have to consent, and this should have been the law or the rule to form this federation. But the majority, that was the winner of that war, they implemented it with a majority vote. And so one can say this Swiss Confederation, I would like to attack in this lawsuit, legally is not existing at all. You know, this is a non-binding basis, and that could be one of many arguments again against this organization. And this in turn says that at the beginning already, or at least in the beginning, these cantons were quite powerful. But in the meantime, I think one can say that more and more competences went to the central state, what legislation is concerned, you know, what general regulation in financial issues, in health issues, in whatever. There are many, many centralized regulations that are sometimes also from the center, administrated from the center. Nevertheless, you're right, the taxes, the bigger part is levied by the cantons. But just as an example for centralization, about 15 years ago, there was a federal statute forcing the cantons to harmonize the structure of their taxes, not the rates, but the structure, what is taxed, what is not taxed, what can you deduct, things like that, that should be uniformed. And of course, this was already a reduction of competition between the cantons. And there is a lot of, you know, harmonization on a political level towards a uniformed tax rate. There are still differences, nevertheless, you're right.
So let me just follow this up a bit. We can certainly agree that the trends in Switzerland are in the wrong way towards centralization, but still, with regard to all first world countries, second world countries, third world countries, and fourth world countries, it is still the case, I believe, that at the provincial level, and or at the state level, if you will, if you're in the United States context, the power and the functions of the local government are stronger in Switzerland than in any other country. Would you agree with that?
Whether the local power is that much stronger than in other countries?
Correct. That's the question, and I wonder if you'd agree with that.
In comparison with other countries, so to think about, I do not know, in the United States? Or,
no, I will. I would tend to disagree with that, because the units are so small, you know these people on a personal level. You get many things done very quickly, which in larger entities would require far more bureaucracy. I mean, even in a smaller country like Austria, if you don't live in Vienna, to get bureaucratic things done is comparatively easy. You know the mayor of your village. You go there, he knows you, and it sometimes takes only minutes, and you accomplished what you do. If you would do that, let's say, in New York City, or in Los Angeles, or in Vienna, or in Berlin, it might take you days to get the same thing accomplished that in small regions you can accomplish within a few minutes. And I think that's in Switzerland.
Yes, I agree with that. And even within Switzerland, I think you can see that in smaller canton, it's more this way than in bigger ones. That the administration in the relatively big cantons is far away from the people than in smaller. And I think that has to do with just the size of it and how close are there. Maybe it's difficult to compare with other countries, you know, how it's there. But I would say this is a
I should also recall what Daniel Mordell said on this. When it came to this tax issue, that sometimes because you know the taxmen and they understand what your problems are, they are sometimes more reasonable than the federal politicians would be, listen more easily to your demand because they understand the local repercussions of their own actions better than in any highly centralized organization. I mean, Liechtenstein is another example. I mean, in Liechtenstein, you would have, in a way, you have access to the prince. You can appeal directly to him, if need be. There's nothing like this even imaginable in a country like Germany. I cannot directly go to Mrs. Merkel. And demand an answer from her, but I can in very small places that it is the possibility does exist. That's why I have always advocated the breakup of the European Union and replacing it with 1,000 Liechtensteins, smaller units where people know each other. It is also more difficult to rip off other people by democratic vote because people know this is a crook and he tries to rip off this guy who is an honest man. Whereas in Germany, of course, we have far more crooks than we have in Switzerland, and an honest man cannot be distinguished from a crook. In a small village, everybody knows this is a crook and this is an honest man. In Germany, my suspicion is most of them are crooks.
So as a corollary, we've established, I think, that small is good when it comes to the quality of the services of our government, and that Switzerland, having many small cantons, is right up there in quality of government. So I'd like to ask Doug, from the standpoint of small and good countries, many of the ones you've mentioned were large ones. What are your favorites among small countries?
Small countries.
Small populations like Iceland, for example.
How about the Cayman Islands?
That's not bad.
That's not a bad choice. It's convenient in the Western Hemisphere, advanced. I think in the Western Hemisphere, if I was looking for a mellow place, I think I would choose the Caymans.
Any others?
Small. Huh. Well, another small place in the Western Hemisphere, but it's nothing like the Caymans. But I like it a lot. Is Suriname? It's completely chaotic because you've got five different racial groups that are all antagonistic. And three major religions that are all antagonistic. And it's only 400,000 people, and the country is about the size of Georgia. Basically empty. Nobody even knows Suriname exists. That would be, believe it or not, it's totally different from the Caymans. That might be my second choice. I mean, small countries, you know, Costa Rica used to be a favorite. Forget about it. It's overrun with gringos from US and Canada. Forget about that. No, small. Uruguay, another small country. Nice. I mean, it's a nice little communist country. But I don't know. Small country. No, that's about it.
Is there somebody who can pass a microphone around, please?
May I? Sorry, I have the mic. Doug, I found Austrian economics and libertarianism well over a decade and a half ago because of my former interest in Canadian gold mines. I'm often told that the logical conclusion of libertarianism is laissez-faire government that leads to anarchy and special interest corruption. That would inevitably take over and fill the void of smaller government. It's a thin veil for anarchism, my friends say at our dinner parties when the topic comes up, cronyism, and a complete breakdown of the environment and social and cultural degradation. My question to you is, will the greed and ambition of industrialists, corporate abuses that already run rampant, subscribe to the motto, get the government out so I can make more money? And how do you stop it from metastasizing into corporate tyranny, leading to slave labor, dumping of toxic chemicals, and more Monsanto atrocities? Of course, as I said, I am here at this conference because I do subscribe to these values, but what do I say and what do you say, because you've heard this many more times than I have?
Well, whenever I go to a dinner party, I don't disguise anything. I always, you know, when these idiotic Republicans and Democrats start talking, I'm happy to identify myself as an anarcho-capitalist and say that pox on both your houses and the government doesn't serve a useful purpose. And you're also talking about the business. And business is not the friend of anarcho-capitalists, because they're all fascists that love their relationship with the state so they can slop at the trough first before anybody else. So the whole system that we have right now is unbelievably corrupt. But I don't know what the answer is. I really don't know. I just try to enjoy myself.
With respect to business being sympathetic or not to it, I remember teaching at UNLV for decades, and the students, of course, recognized after 2 days what the drift of my views was, and then they always said, "Oh, you must be enormously rich. All businessmen must come and support you for your free market views." And the answer is, of course, the opposite is the truth. And I think Adam Smith actually pointed out there's every opportunity that businessmen have to get together is lobbying for certain exemptions, for certain privileges. They all want competition for everything except those things in which they themselves have their activity. So businessmen, except small-scale businessmen and some unusual exceptions, are not donors to institutes, let's say, like the Mises Institute at all. As a matter of fact, they live by and large from donations that come from moms and dads and grandpas and grandmas who send in $100 donations or maybe $1,000. But that's it. So to put the hope in businessmen, that is a wrong hope.
Ayn Rand had this essay, Businessmen, the Most Persecuted Minority. I think the exact opposite of this, that is true. One of my criteria for anything is, how did they treat Ron Paul? And big business did not treat Ron Paul too well. But as Hans says, there are exceptions, very rare exceptions.
Following on from this, I have a question to Dr. Block in light of his talk. Do you think there's much merit in the work of left-wing libertarians like Kevin Carson, Sheldon Richman, and Gary Chartier? Do you think, for instance, that absent various government interventions in the market, like the environmental restrictions, like indirect taxes, like direct subsidies, overinvestment in transport and communication networks. Do you think that absent all of this, big business wouldn't be able to take advantage of economies of scale to the extent that they can?
Well, I'm a real bitter opponent of these left-wing libertarians. They're thick libertarians. I mean, they don't just stick to the non-aggression principle. They add on, you have to be nice to gays or to women or whoever. I think they're almost worse than our friends on the left, the pure left, because at least they should know better. I mean, Sheldon Richman used to be pretty good. And Roderick Long and some of these other people, Kevin is horrible. So I would say an even lower rung is reserved in hell for people who should know better than for your honest Marxist who, you know, you have to excuse your honest Marxist because he's a Marxist, what does he know? But, you know, these are people that have read Rothbard. Speaking of people who have read Rothbard, in the last election for who would be the candidate for the Libertarian Party, there were candidates who had never heard of Rothbard. And even Gary Johnson, I think his acquaintance with Murray, I mean, to me, Murray Rothbard is sort of a litmus test for libertarianism. He's Mr. Libertarian. And if you so much as never heard of him, that's a big problem. And if you've heard of him and reject him, that's perhaps even a bigger problem. So I'm not a big fan of these left-wing so-called libertarians.
They even had conferences where people said in public, if I would see a Rothbard crossing the street, I would try to make him roadkill. So I can only re-emphasize what Walter said. These people have become our biggest enemies in the meantime. And they are much worse than normal people that have never heard anything about libertarianism in their life.
I have a question for Mr. Doug Casey. You haven't spoken about the biggest country in the world.
Russia.
My image of Russia always was a cold, bitter place full of communists, but now they have Odessa and the Krim, and I'm like, maybe it would be a good place to move to. And when you talk about the mafia in the US, I see the mafia in the West growing, and there's some kind of consolidation of the mafia in Moscow. There is still mafia in any country, but I have the feeling it's getting more stable over there. I also see in the East that they are actually giving away land to people who want to settle there. It's very cold there, but what is your take on Russia?
I think they're smart giving away the land because the Chinese are going to take it away from them if they don't do something. That would be logical. But you've heard that expression, there are more communists in American universities than there are in all of Russia today. And I think that's true. So I'm a fan of Russia. I mean, look, it's got a 10% income tax. And if you want to try to do business there, you just need to get a krisha for yourself, a roof, you know, some big man that can shield you from the mafiosa types. And hey, it's good enough for Edward Snowden. So I'm very pro-Russian, and I'm disgusted by the American media that are trying to turn Putin into a devil and Russia into a new enemy. Putin's not a nice guy, he's no libertarian, and Russia's got problems. But, you know, the things that are said about it in the media, I think, are horribly untrue, generally.
When I hear the word snow and socialism, I think of Minnesota and Sweden, not Russia. I'm one of the people that started this group called Libertarians for Trump. I mean, Trump says he can get along with Putin. Hillary calls Putin a Hitler, and calling someone a Hitler is not a good thing. So I certainly agree with you and with Doug that there are more socialists in academe, and I probably know better than Doug because I'm in academe, and I swear Doug is absolutely correct.
I have a question for the professors Dürr and Hoppe, and this is this. given that the arguments in favor of social contract and in favor of the legitimacy of the state are logically faulty and they can't resist scrutiny by a serious philosophy, as Professor Hoppe showed us with the ethics of argumentation, still we are left with lots of people who actually not only accept the state, but accept to be in a relationship with an entity which has power of supremacy, which they think is justified and legitimate. And an author recently proposed a psychological explanation, and he wrote that maybe most of the people are in a gigantic Stockholm syndrome, given that they are hostages of the state. They tend to identify with the state and they tend to attribute positive features to this, which is in reality an enemy of humanity and of justice. What do you think of this psychological approach in order to try to understand what the great majority of people is nonetheless thinking about this institution?
From a psychological point of view, I could imagine that it has to do with really fundamental levels of personality. I mean, this is a bit Sigmund Freud, you know, that you have sort of orientation to a fixed point somewhere, and the characteristic of a really absolute fixed point is that he is the fixed point of all, not just of me. It's the alpha animal, you know. I'm best protected if this alpha animal is the alpha animal of all others as well, so I can refer to him to get protected and things like that. What is a bit strange is if you look at it from this point of view, and I do not know whether in that direction goes your question, but if you look at it, you have the surprising phenomenon that this state paradigm, one says paradigm, the paradigm, this state paradigm is almost everywhere in the world, in all countries. There are how many countries in the world?
200.
So you have 200 sole supreme points of orientation, which is a contradiction in it, you know. All these countries or the people who support this kind of thinking in these countries are ready to accept that there are many other such alpha animals as well, so that the principle of alpha animal is sufficient just for their surroundings, which could be an argument to say, look, it's not that absolute. There are 199 others beside your country as well that could be help, you know, to show the relativity of this absolute point. Something in addition to this is that what I think libertarians and anarcho-libertarians should always underline very much, I sometimes forget to do it. I mentioned it today briefly, that nobody wants to take away the state from anybody who wants it for himself. You know, as long as it's a voluntary membership, like of a church or some enterprise or some cooperative or whatever, there's nothing against it. And even if this cooperative is a truly socialist one, you know, why not? Why shouldn't you be free to organize yourself for the voluntary members, of course, in an absolutely collectivist way? I wish you good luck for your enterprise. I do not, you know, promise you too much success, but why not? Go ahead and do it. But do not force anybody to become a member of your club without his signature. Okay, this is me.
But there's also a material basis to this psychological phenomenon of the Stockholm syndrome or whatever it's called. We have to realize that, of course, in the meantime, at least in all the Western states, far more than the majority of the population are, as far as their income is concerned, directly or indirectly dependent on the state. I think last year I gave a speech and I did some rough calculations and found out that only about a third of the population in the country of the free and the brave are actually completely or more or less completely independent of the state. One third. Because obviously you have to even include all the retired people, even those retired people who have paid into Social Security system, that is not an account that they personally own, that something is actually paid to them at the end of their working career, depends on the state doing it. So if you include all the old people, you get to numbers like this, one third of the population in the United States, in other countries that might be even worse. So that they feel like, start liking the state, loving the state, has of course a material basis.
I'd like to add a bit. First of all, I sometimes joke around and say that I'm not really an anarcho-capitalist. I believe in one function of government, and that's to force everyone to read Man, Economy, and State and to pay taxes for that, but I'm just kidding. I really am an anarcho-capitalist. I'd like to add to what Hans said about 1,000 Liechtensteins instead of the EU, and ideally, we really want 7 billion countries. One for each of us. We should each be sovereign in our country. So if you want to ask a girl out for a date, you have to get your foreign minister to deal with her foreign minister and set up a date. I would like to criticize my colleague David here on one very small point, and maybe we're just having a verbal dispute, but I'm certainly 100% with him in spirit, but I have this one little difficulty. Now, I agree that you should have a voluntary socialism, the kibbutz, the commune, whatever, and if they want to be commies, fine, as long as they do it on their own. But I don't agree that we should allow people to contribute to the state. For example, Barbara Streisand, an actress, a singer, contributes money to the government to show her love for the government. Well, it seems to me that when we have the Nuremberg trial for these, when we libertarians take over and have a Nuremberg trial, Barbara Streisand is going to be in the dock, and she shouldn't have been giving money to the state. The state is a robber gang. So if you want to have a commune or a kibbutz or a whatever, fine. But nobody should be contributing to the government. The government is a robber gang, and I was speaking to Hans about this before, and we have to punish them during the Nuremberg trial. I like the idea of a Nuremberg trial, because even whether we have one or a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, that doesn't matter. But to think in these terms is to show who's guilty of what. So I would diverge very, very slightly from this point of it's okay to donate to the state, and if you agree to the state, you're a good guy. No, you're a bad guy. You're aiding and abetting criminals.
I slightly disagree with Walter. This was, I'm a far more generous person. Only the hardcore criminals who have committed hardcore crimes should be punished. For the rest, we forgive their past sins for the sake of peace.
I'm such a wimp.
I'm not quite sure. Maybe I didn't understand you well, but my idea is that this voluntary membership with the state is admittable, is agreeable. Of course, in a world where the state is not the first gang anymore, but just maybe a gang or an organization.
But so would you punish past crimes?
You mean of past crimes? Okay, yes. Maybe that, was that the difference?
Yeah.
You mean?
Well, that was one difference, but the point is that if it's not the first gang, it's not a state anymore. It's just a voluntary organization. I have no problem with people voluntarily. If Bernie Sanders wants to set up a commune, fine. But while the state is still the first gang, Barbra Streisand is giving money to the U.S. government. She's a criminal.
But right now, it's still the first gang with who is not only based on voluntary memberships, and as long as this is not the case, then also I would say do not support it at all. only in a situation where everybody is really free to become a member or not, or maybe to withdraw his membership.
Well, I think we agree. We're just having a verbal dispute. I think that once they're not the first gang, they're not a state at all. And then it's fine to contribute to them, but while they're still a state, like Barbra Streisand is contributing voluntarily to a state, she's a bad guy or a bad girl or whatever you want to say.
Walter wants revenge. I want peace.
I would say that he is not the state anymore, maybe what terminology is concerned. It is not a state anymore from definition. If in that other world, in the future world, peoples are lucky to call this organization state, then go ahead and call it state. Like Catholics, they also say Catholic Church. And Catholic, Catholos, means about everything, you know. Everybody actually belongs to this organization who administers the only truth. Maybe the people do not know that they belong to it, but actually they do. Okay, go ahead and be happy with this, as long as do not force them.
But I've got to say, I'm 100% on Walter's side from a psychological point of view. Totally with you. But from a practical point of view, I've got to say we've got to be a little bit more towards the South African Peace and Reconciliation Commissions, because we libertarians are genetic freaks, and we're going to be totally overwhelmed by the enemy. So, we should put our best foot forward, because we're the ones that are likely to go up against the wall, not the bad guys.
I think we are genetic freaks. My interpretation of why we're so few is because most people are hardwired towards socialism. That's why Ron Paul gets 1 or 2% of the vote. And I agree with Doug. As a practical matter, the Truth and Reconciliation Committee is a much better idea. But as an intellectual vehicle, it's good to think in terms of who is guilty and who is not. Because all libertarian punishment theory gives is what's the most we can do to the criminal, but we don't have to do that much. We can do much less as a practical matter.
In theory, of course, we agree on all of this. It is just, how would we handle it when it comes to that point? And there we are for reconciliation, I think.
Hello, I have a question for Doug Casey. In your analysis of which countries to live in and which places are more attractive, I was wondering, what is your prognosis, or perhaps what is your opinion, considering the emergence of local secessionist independence movements in some of these countries? If some of them are successful, would that change your analysis of which country could be better than others?
Well, that's one of the bright spots for Europe, is that there are actually a good number of secessionist movements here in Europe. And Italy, the people around Venice, and the Catalans, and the Basques, and in Quebec, and in Canada, there's a whole bunch of them. I mean, a bunch of places in Russia are really, Russia's Soviet Union was a big empire, and Russia's a smaller empire, and a lot of places there are going to break off. So I think that this is what, don't worry about these globalists that are trying to make one world and one world currency, because it's more likely that the whole world is going to resemble what happened to the Soviet Union, and then what happened to Yugoslavia that broke up, and then it happened to Czechoslovakia that broke up, and hopefully it's going to happen to the UK with Scotland and maybe Wales. So I'm optimistic, and I promise you that the United States is not going, the colors of the map on the wall showing the United States is going to, it's going to break up into regions too, absolutely. And so Canada, it's not just Quebec. I think it's the Maritimes will break off, and British Columbia is totally different from Ontario, and Alberta's, that's going to happen, I think.
There's also California and Texas, where there are movements in this direction.
I promise I'm not trying to reconvene Walter's Nuremberg trial here. My question is for David. In terms of taking the state to court, would that be taking the the corporate entity of the state to court, or would you imagine that would be taking the individuals occupying the offices of the state and using public law to protect them from the wrath of private law in doing so? What are your thoughts there?
So you mean in this lawsuit I'm going to prepare, who will be precisely defined the defendant? And I would say you could look at it, you know, the main claim of this concept the main claim is not to punish this cooperative, this organization for damages. This also will be a claim, but maybe the secondary. The primary claim is release us out of the compulsory membership. And this is, by the way, that's quite interesting, a question that arrives in private law, which is a good benchmark for many questions, which arrives there in very comparable situations. Schweizerische Eidgenossenschaft, this entity of the state as a whole in Switzerland, is called, as I said, Eidgenossenschaft, which means cooperative, a oath, a solemn oath, cooperative. So, and there are a lot of private cooperative societies, a certain structure of a, as we call it, a person, a legal person, juristische Person, it's not a natural person, it's a legal person, but under legal terms, what lawsuits are concerned, and so it's then the party of this lawsuit. And sometimes for the lawyer is the question, now who is the right defendant? Shall I attack the group, the entity as such, or maybe the board of directors or some members or whatever? And this claim to pretend the right and to have granted the right to secede out of this organization, it's quite clear this is a claim against the organization as such. I would not say the claim is that it must be dissolved. Again, for those who want to remain there, keep your membership. I do not want to hinder you, but for me, please, cooperative, you as an entity, release me out of membership. No, not please, but let me out of membership. And this is directed against the state as such. Now, sometimes in questions like that, some claims then nevertheless could be addressed against certain organs, you know, certain natural people that had some role. And maybe if they, what damages are concerned and things like that, it could be that you can blame them personally for having, you know, done unlawful things that you were not allowed to do. You forced it. You used appropriate measures or whatever. Then there could be a possibility to also claim against it. But the principal claim is against the state as such.
The microphone, yes, please.
A question for Doug of the panel regarding Doug's comment regarding migration. Are you sure it's too late? Cannot something be done about it, since there are many people that still like to stay in Europe, if not become a petting zoo? But in the migration issue, some parts of Europe have taken a somewhat different path, for example, Hungary and Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I guess it's never too late, and I'm sure that there's not going to be migration into Eastern Europe. It just doesn't seem like that's going to happen. But the only way to stop this migration, if you don't like it, maybe somebody does like it, is, number one, all property has to be privately owned. Then how's a migrant going to go on property if the sidewalks are privately owned and the areas under the bridges where they sleep are privately owned? Then there's no place for them to be. So that's number one. And number two, you have to abolish all the welfare of whatever type, which is attracting these people as like a magnet. So it would be a non-problem if we lived in a real capitalist world But as long as you have socialism and state property, you're not going to be able to stop them. There's going to be millions of these people that are going to be coming here, and it's, I don't know. I guess they'll stop them with guns at the border, and then you've got a scandal where thousands of these people are dying in the Mediterranean, and who the, you know, it's awful. But I think that's what's going to happen.
I just wanted to mention a word about the secessionist movement like Quebec or the Basques or the Catalans or Irish. Isn't it amazing that they're all lefties? Virtually, I think there might be one. I'm sorry? Okay, one exception. Thank God for the Flemish. We have a colleague right next to you, to your left, who's from Quebec, and he agrees with me, or I agree with him, that it's very important that libertarians too become part of this secession of movement and not leave it to almost the monopoly or almost all on the left.
I have a question for Walter Block. Walter, I agree with every word you said during your talk this morning, but there's no fun in that. So I would like to disagree with you over something that you didn't say. A little bit tongue-in-cheek, as you'll appreciate, but there is a sort of serious thing behind the... it's quite clear, you know, to anybody that the free market for goods and services works better than anything else, and I can't imagine that any... I just don't understand the arguments. But there is one area in the free market where I think we can justifiably say that we have failed, and it's paradoxically the area where we are strongest. In the free market for ideas, it's lousy ideas that seem to get the upper hand. In the free market for ideas, Paul Krugman makes more money than Walter Block, and John Maynard Keynes gets greater acclaim than Ludwig von Mises. Now, I know the answer will be that there really is no free market for ideas because governments and the rich and powerful are buying the ideas. But then the essence of the free market is that people should do what they want with their own money. Well, the rich and powerful are using their money to buy intellectuals. And they have bought the intellectuals who tout the ideas which people are buying and which lead to their own immiseration. Whereas in the market for goods and services, people who sell shoddy goods and bad services will go bankrupt. In the market for ideas, it's the peddlers of snake oil that get all the kudos. Perhaps one of the reasons for that is probably you alluded to earlier that people are hardwired for socialism. So unfortunately, but maybe there's another one. Maybe there is a failing amongst free market intellectuals in that they haven't realized ideas on their own cannot really persuade people to change their minds. We are so enamored of the sheer intellectual elegance of the case for the free market that we seem to have failed to appreciate this, that these ideas cannot grow unless we create an ambience, a zeitgeist, an intellectual and moral, ethical zeitgeist in which they can thrive. And I don't think we have paid enough, perhaps, that's my guess, enough attention to the need, not only for ideas, but also for a cultural and ethical zeitgeist.
It's interesting to be criticized for something I didn't say. when you first mentioned intellectual ideas, I thought you were going to talk about intellectual property, and I would announce that I'm a Kinsellian on this. I think Stefan Kinsella has really nailed it solidly. Rap music gets a lot more dollar votes than Mozart, and I'm a Mozart fan, and I'm willing to say that he's better in some sense than rap music or other kinds of music. But I don't think it's fair to say that we people here, the intellectuals of the movement, haven't done our best. We've done our best. We're trying to make a zeitgeist. I'm sorry, I can't hear. Well, obviously it's not good enough. I mean, there should be 10,000 people at this meeting.
Yep.
And there are maybe less than 100. There would have been 200 had it not been for the problems. But Ron Paul should be president of the U.S., and the U.S. military should get out of the 160 out of 200 countries that they're now in. Obviously, we're not doing as well as we could. We should all do better. We should all work harder. I agree. We should all work harder and smarter and better. But most of us are doing our best. I think the reason is that we're doing so poorly is because people are hardwired biologically. I'm a big fan of sociobiology, which says that we are hardwired toward accepting a ruler, an alpha male, to tell us what to do. A little bit about sociology for a minute. Nobody here is afraid of a bathtub. Everybody here is afraid of a snake. Why is that? Because a million years ago when we were in the caves or the trees, if you were afraid of a bathtub, it didn't give you any benefit of leaving your genetic essence to the next generation. Whereas if you were not afraid of a snake, it negatively impacted you. And I think that there must have been some genetic benefit in benevolence. When I get new freshman students and they hear about price gouging, they're horrified. And yet they don't realize that price gouging is the way to bring more stuff to the beleaguered place like, say, New Orleans. And it's only by pushing at them that I try to get them convinced that markets are a benefit. But they come into the class, part of it is from high school and part of it, I think, is genetic whatever. They're just disposed not in favor of free enterprise, but in favor of benevolence, and they don't realize that the markets are the best way to promote human well-being. So it's sort of like the rock of Sisyphus. You know, we push it up, it comes down. We push it up, it comes down. We have to keep pushing.
I'm not sure about that hardwiring stuff. I'm also interested in sociobiology, but I'm not convinced of this. In any case, I think what we should do is we have to offer extra benefits besides only the arguments. And this is actually what I'm trying to do here, to offer the extra benefits, a nice atmosphere. Last year, my wife said it, we are the Club Med of libertarians. So if we would be capable of creating atmospheres like this at many places, we might also get people who come here not just for the ideas, but also for things like the boat ride tomorrow and so forth. So we must have a compound product that has more and additional benefits than simply believing this is right. It must be right and beautiful and charming and all the rest of it. And with this,
go ahead.
No, actually, I wanted to now close our meeting, but if you want to say something, please do so.
Just, to add something to this, I understand this very good that how shall we convince as many people as possible of this? But I think this is, in principle, the maybe it's the political approach or a sociological approach or an anthropological or however approach, that the way of thinking of the people should be changed. And maybe this is to do, I wouldn't deny it, but I think we should not forget that it's not just a matter of those many maybe are not yet thinking in a way which is more plausible or more justified, but that those very few who think like us are victim of a big aggression. And so it might be a way to try to convince the aggressor that he is bad, but why not, at least in addition, to fight for our right not to be attacked? And this is precisely what I wanted to show with this more or less realistic project, that a really consequent approach could be the legal one, which is not one of convincing the counterparty, but maintaining our rights not to be attacked. And if we are just 1% of society, there is no reason that 99% have the right to attack us. If they think like as they think, then do it, but do not attack our percent.
Walter wants to have the last word, because that is Walter's style. To win any debate, you have to be the last one to say something.
I was only going to take 30 seconds, but now I'm going to have to take another 30 seconds to explain that. What happened was that some Chicagoans said that the reason Chicago economics is better than Austrian economics is they have a majority. There are more Chicagoans than Austrians. And I wrote a paper with two colleagues, and I said, this is silly, but if you want to have objective criteria of who's ahead, the last one to win, the last one to publish an article is the winner. And I said, obviously, it's silly because sometimes people die in the middle of a debate or they don't think it's worthy. But so what I did is I took 100 or 175 debates between Austrians and Chicagoans, and I asked who was the last speaker or the last publisher, and we had about 100 and they had about 70. So Austrianism is better. I just wanted to add.
Walter won all the debates against me because he never stopped publishing.
The other point I want to make is, who are the two people who have been most successful in converting masses of people to libertarianism? Obviously, Ayn Rand and Ron Paul. Ron Paul, mainly intellectual, economics, political science, what have you. Ayn Rand, a novel. I wanted to mention that Doug Casey is now a novelist. Not yet. He hasn't published this novel yet. It's coming out in a week.
At the end of September, it's called Speculator. And it's the first of a sextet.
And I just read it, and it is magnificent. So we should all come and become novelists.
Okay, with this, now I finally have the last word. After all, so I won all the debates against Walter. We see each other at dinner. Thank you very much for coming.